from the clubhouse to the tailgates and beyond.
Fly ball, deep left, gone!
Welcome to Brewers Weekly. Here's your host, Dominic Catronio.
Brewers have a fantastic homestand against the Phillies and the Guardians. Now they hit the road for one of the best in the National League with the Atlanta Braves. Of course, it's not a full sweep, but it's still a 4-2 homestand, two series wins. We are never, ever, ever, ever complaining about series wins, especially against two teams that are currently in the playoff picture. So the Brewers, yes, they fall on Thursday by a 4-2 final, kind of a frustrating mud fight of a game. We'll talk about that here, get that out of the way in the top of the show. Then we'll hear from Quinn Priester. We finally got an update on his injury dealing with thoracic outlet syndrome. His season is over. He is going to opt for surgery on Monday. We'll hear him explain all of that here on this episode of Brewers Weekly. We also have an interview with Garrett Mitchell on the very back end of this show. Audio of Garrett. We talked before the game today about the start to his season, the numbers that he's been putting up, and how strong of a start to the year that it's been for him. Just to finally see him back on the field is certainly encouraging too. But maybe what I'm most proud of in this episode, I hope you stick around for, and I shared it on social too, is a breakdown I did of Jacob Mizorowski since he throws on Friday against the Braves. And looking at the Miz from the beginning of September last year to the Miz right now, what are the differences mechanically? What should you be looking for when you watch him pitch against the Braves tomorrow? So we have some visuals, we have some lines, we have some comparative stuff here. So I'm really proud of that one. I hope you enjoy that breakdown coming up here in the show. A reminder here at the top, if you're listening live on WTMJ, a reminder, all these shows are pre-taped these days. So I'm not interacting with the text line. I'm not interacting with the call line tonight. These are all available in podcast form. Brewers All Access wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on ESPN Milwaukee first thing Friday morning over on YouTube. And you can see the breakdown of Jacob Mizorowski that we're talking about. And you'll hear Quinn Priester talk about everything he went through in this last 3 months or so trying to figure out what is wrong with his arm. So that's off the top of the program. Again, we're not talking texts, calls, or anything like that, but let's get today's game out of the way here first. A 4-2 loss to the Guardians. It's no sweep. Parker Messick was really, really darn good. He got stronger as the game went on. The Brewers took the lead first early in this game and then just kept missing opportunities, kept failing to add on. They had an opportunity with first and second, nobody out in the bottom of the second inning. They only scored one run in that situation. They went a combined 1-for-12 with runners in scoring position, while simultaneously on the other side, the Guardians, they were hitting the long ball, right? They hit three homers in this one. David Fry off of Shane Drouin, then Kyle Manzardo. That one came off of Joel Kunal, and then a go-ahead homer by Travis Bezzana at the time had made it 3-2 with the Guardians in front. Then they scored their fourth run on a wild pitch from Drew Rom. Now, on social media, people are going to tell you about the bullpen usage and, you know, complaints about the guys that were used in today's game, whatever that may be. Look, here's the first thing I want to say about Joel Kunal and the way that the Brewers acquired him via designating for assignment from the A's. And I know we can all get enamored with velocity. Sometimes, heck, I'm going to talk about Jacob Mizorowski later on in this show. Hey, location still matters, too. A 92-mile-an-hour cutter down the middle is still probably going to get punished, and that's exactly what happened with Kunal against Manzardo. And likewise for Grant Anderson. They go to Bezzana knowing that the lefty was going to give Grant trouble. He's given up four homers this season, and now three of them have come against left-handed pitching. And I'm a big fan of Grant Anderson. Maybe leverage isn't his role. At that point, the Brewers were in a tie game, 2-2, and then he gave it up. And then the second run that came in to score was his run inherited by Drew Rom that came in to score on a wild pitch. But nonetheless, you can't throw Ashby every single game. You can't have it both ways where you want every single game to be a one-run game. The Brewers' offense, in my opinion, is the reason the Brewers lost this game on Thursday. Again, 1-for-12 with runners in scoring position, just two extra base hits, while simultaneously tipping your cap to what Parker Messick was able to do today. Six strong, nine punch, three walks. The Brewers, as cliche and as annoying it is to bring up on a show like this, it's the truth. They did not get the big hit today. They had the bases loaded in the seventh and eighth innings. failed to get anything across in those frames, and that's how she crumbled. This was a slog of a game. I called it a mud fight on social media. 8 walks for the Guardians offense, 9 walks for the Brewers offense. They also struck out 13 times offensively today, 9 of them by Messick. Cade Smith had to do a 4-out save. We saw multiple mid-inning pitching changes. It was just one of them days, and yet the Brewers still won the series, having everything go wrong. They had a tying run at the plate in the 9th inning against an all-star closer in Cade Smith. Again, I've said this cliche before. I'll say it again. If you're going to be a 100-win team this season, you're going to lose 62 of them. All right, they lost one today. They're 45-27. They're still in first place. There is not a lot to freak out about on this team right now. Shane Drouin, he said so post-game. He just wasn't sharp with his command. He tried to find what was working for him mid-game and was really struggling putting hitters away in this contest. He had a ton of 2-strike counts. David Fry really wore him down in this game, having a walk and that home run as well off of Shane. But today was the first day it was really just kind of a ugh. And if this is the floor, if this is kind of the dud of a game for Shane Drouin, then that's still a really quality player. 5 innings, 3 hits, 1 run, it was earned. He hit one batter, allowed a home run, 3 walks, only 3 strikeouts, was not his usual self. His next start will most likely come on Wednesday against the Cincinnati Reds down there in southern Ohio. So that's just a quick look at what today's game was. I can double down and tell you everything that went wrong, but there's more important stuff that I want to talk about, and we got to talk about Quinn Priester. We got the big update from him. We're going to hear from him in a moment as we roll along with this taped edition of Brewers Weekly as they get ready to hit the road for the Atlanta Braves. Back with more in a moment on your home of the Brewers, 620. WTMJ.
Brewers Weekly on WTMJ.
Tough day in the clubhouse as the Brewers made it official with Quinn Priester's season coming to a close. And, you know, Quinn was around the team a little bit on and off. Remember, he's been to backtrack on the timeline right now as we resume Brewers Weekly. Welcome in if you're listening live on WTMJ. A reminder, this is a taped edition of the program here tonight. You can always catch it in podcast form at Brewers All Access, wherever you get your podcasts. Now, for Quinn Priester, started the season on the injured list, trying to rehab and get treated for symptoms of thoracic outlet syndrome. If you're not familiar with what thoracic outlet syndrome is, in its simplest form, it is way more nuanced than how I'm going to explain it, but it is a nerve issue. There's a large contingent of nerves that are connected right under your shoulder, right near your armpit, and then your body can sometimes put pressure on it, which thus creates numbness or pain or tingling in your fingers. This is where it all connected from your brain to your hand and all the nerves and everything that fires from down there. So thoracic outlet syndrome was a really dirty injury, as in, oh no, you don't want to have thoracic outlet, because that was a career ender maybe 10, 15 years ago. But advancements in the medical field have brought about new treatments, trying to avoid surgery, trying to find ways to do it. And that's what Quinn Priester, and you'll hear him explain in a moment, what he was trying to do and what the Brewers were trying to do to say, let's leave no stone unturned. Pat Murphy said as such post-game today that they knew there was a date in the middle of the season that if nothing is working on alternative treatments, that you come to this date in the season and if nothing's working, you can still go get your surgery. And in theory, you will be back in time to be ready at the start or near the start of the 2027 season. So that all played into the decision for Quinn Priester. Remember, he starts the year on the IL, then he begins a rehab assignment. He's walking the world. He gets pulled off that rehab assignment. They reassess. They do some new treatment with the shoulder. He goes back on a rehab assignment. Doesn't go well. Comes back off that rehab assignment. Goes one more time back down to the Arizona Complex League, where you can, you know, reinsert pitchers. You can have spring training-esque rules. Didn't go well in 2 appearances down there. So once again, comes back, goes back to see Dr. Pearl for another assessment, and now we've reached this conclusion of surgery. So let's hear from Quinn in his own words what went into this decision and why now, and the mental, you know, hurdle that it is now. All right, I need to make sure that I'm ready for 2027.
Yeah, so talking to Dr. Pearl again and doing all the things that we had, you know, gone through to try and kind of fix this problem without, you know, surgery is we've just kind of gotten to a point where these things aren't working, so we're going to go down on Monday and get surgery with Dr. Pearl, make sure we clean this issue up so that the rest of, you know, my career, this isn't an issue. I think, you know, 10 years ago, this was a little bit more of a, you know, question mark, but now as things progress, like anything in the medical field, like, feel really, really confident that we're going to come back even better, clean some of this stuff up, make sure that it's not an issue going forward. It's not something that we're trying to manage and just worrying about getting outs and pitching for the Brewers.
What were the things that put you over the top in making that decision? Obviously, you didn't.
Yeah, so there's a couple things that you can do. You typically, with the TOS, it's diagnosis of exclusion, which means you kind of have to check every box to make sure it's not this. It's not a bicep tendon. It's not the wrist. It's not all these things together. And so you kind of have to go down every avenue. And then once you go down all those avenues, we had a, you know, Botox into my pec minor and scalenes. You know, we had gotten pain relief from that, but essentially part of the neurogenic TOS diagnosis is the loss of proprioception above the head and past the, you know, as I'm extending, and that's causing a lot of the control issues that, you know, we work really, really diligently, really, really hard mechanically, but when the brain and arm aren't communicating in the right way because of this, you know, diagnosis, because of the nerves that are kind of pinching in there, it makes it nearly impossible to actually create a result that's repeatable. And it was great that we had gotten the pain to go away with the nerve blocks, but essentially we couldn't alleviate all the symptoms, which we really did try to go down every avenue to try and help the team this year. And but at this point, you know, we're going to start repeating the same treatments rather than going in and ultimately getting a complete fix from this situation, and then being 100% next year with no reservations, wondering whether this is going to become an issue again. And I think, for, you know, it's just the best decision for the organization to make sure, like, hey, I'm 100% next year, not 90 or 95%, let alone the mental thing of, hey, this isn't completely cleared up, and then just be able to hit the ground running for next season and be ready to help, you know, next spring.
What kind of timeline did they give you in terms of throwing again, being on a mound and doing the off-season work that you
needed? Yeah, so 8 to 10 weeks, then we'll throw plyos. So 8 to 10 weeks after surgery, throw plyos, 12 weeks light catch, and then it's a build-up from, you know, after that three-month period out of baseball. And essentially what we've seen, other people, it's kind of that 8 to 10 month range before you're back at 100% physically, just recovering and kind of building the arm back up. But I'm confident with my body, and I'm still a pretty young guy, that be able to make that a little bit quicker, be diligent with the work, and like I said, be ready to compete for a spot in spring training next year.
How do you view it mentally, like going back to spring training versus the guy now, of your internal conflict of, right, do I just get the surgery? Do I rehab and fight through it? How did you go through that process?
Absolutely. So essentially, we'd done everything. We wanted to turn over every stone that wasn't surgery, if that makes sense. Whether that's scraping, needling, cupping, hot tub, warming up before, after, BFR machines. Like, we really did try and go down every avenue here. And, the nerve blocks, again, invasive and non. And ultimately, we just weren't getting the result. We ended up getting to a pain-free spot, but in terms of the command, you know how important consistency is to be here and to be, you know, good for this team and an actual option that, you know, we feel confident that every time I go out, I'm going to win, kind of like how I felt last year. So if we don't have that, it's not anything I can control. And God knows that we have some of the best staff members, if not the best staff, to be able to help through those situations. And we just kind of came to the conclusion that, hey, we've worked really hard at this. We've done everything we can. And unfortunately, this is the next step. But I'm excited because it's a plan forward, and something that we can execute on. Like, the hardest part of the last couple months have been the not knowing on, hey, we're going to try this at 100%. and then it not kind of work. And so being able to go into this really confidently, knowing that we did everything we could, and now that this is the right next step for us, I do feel good about it. It's obviously, you know, the lesser of an evil, but I feel really good about this direction and being able to, you know, contribute in 2027.
Can you tell us about the feeling on the mound and how hard it's been to feel okay and then the ball not come out the way it's supposed to? How hard is that going during this process?
It's definitely, it's been a mental challenge for sure. And it's hard to go out and have the results that I've, you know, had this year, but continue to wake up and say, hey, we're gonna get through this at some point. I felt like that was the best mentality to maintain just for confidence sake and for getting off the mat, because some of those outings were rough ones, you know, and not ones that I'm accustomed to, even when I have a bad game. You know what I mean? It wasn't like, oh, these are just bad games. Like, these are uncontrollable things that they're definitely difficult to go to bed and wake up and be like, well, I'm just going to figure it out tomorrow. And obviously it didn't really happen. And so, you know, definitely mentally it was difficult. But again, I have really great people around me. My wife, I work with psychologists. Obviously the team has been nothing but helpful. Murph's been so supportive of everything. Hooky, Brad, Bryn, Brett Walker down in Arizona, like all these guys have really, really helped me get through this in the mental side, and kind of thorny down there in Nashville too. Again, so many people that really did make this doable, because again, kind of 3-4 months of really trying things can be tough. So it's definitely a huge credit to the people around me. Especially my wife, who Reagan has gone through a lot of ups and downs. So very thankful for that. But you know, confident going forward that this is the right decision. This is going to get me back and better than I was.
So our thanks to Quinn for talking to us about that. I mean, no one likes to be injured, right? It's just a kind of a dud of a day. It stinks to lose a season, but he's 25 years old. He still has 4 more full seasons of control after this season, okay? And again, the reason they're doing it now, here coming up on Monday, is in theory, he should be back pitching off a mound as a starting pitcher next spring training and rebuilding back up. You're playing catch in 3 months' time. You're fully built up somewhere between 8 and 10 months, which would put you right around February, March time for 2027. So best of luck to Quinn. Wish him a speedy and healthy recovery. And he's just a great guy to talk to in the clubhouse too. That's just a real bummer, because he's, as you heard, the dude's smart. It's just really, really impressive young man to be able to kind of understand the surgery that he's going under and the procedure and everything like that. It is, by the way, you do remove the first rib and you get to keep it. That's part of the bit. Zach Wheeler had the same sort of treatment last year. Now, his was a different style of thoracic outlet, where he was dealing with blood clots. Quinn Priester is not. So there's a slight difference in the diagnoses between those two pitchers, because it's natural going to be compared between the two. Well, Zach Wheeler came back and he's fine. Well, it's not quite the same. So let's hope for the best for Quinn Priester moving forward. Now, up next, we are going to have the breakdown of Jacob Mazurowski's pitching mechanics. This is something, if you're listening on the radio, I would encourage you to sit back and actually go over to the YouTube side tomorrow morning. I will share this on social media as well to see the visuals. I'm a big believer that seeing is believing, and you can really see the adjustments from Miz a lot easier over on the YouTube side than I can in audio form here too. So I would encourage you to check that out, but let's break that down. Jacob Mazurowski, what is different in just, you know, 6-7 months time from a guy last year that was begging to make the postseason roster and did, to now maybe being the front runner for the Cy Young Award? Back with more in a moment on 620 WTMJ.
It's Brewers Weekly on WTMJ.
Okay, welcome back. This is what I talked about earlier in the show, pre-recorded segment that I did before the game on Wednesday. Now, granted, Miz doesn't pitch until tomorrow, Friday. So as we kind of break this down, I want to prerequisite this breakdown saying, I've talked to Miz, I've talked to Chris Hook about these changes, and I am not a pitching coach, but I'm just trying to explain what they explained to me of how he goes from 99 to 100 a year ago to now 103 with adrenaline in the ninth inning of a complete game shutout, right? But these are some of the very, very small mechanical things that we talk about with Jacob Mazurowski and with Chris Hook and the entire pitching team that help him unlock another level. And for young pitchers out there, for young coaches out there, maybe you watch this and you realize, A, he's a freak, right? As in, Miz has a God-given ability to throw a baseball. But also, B, is the fact that you will notice changes in his body. The two starts I chose were the two against the Phillies. Last Labor Day on September 1st, and then, of course, the 15-punch-out, epic, near-perfect game last Friday against the Phillies. So same opponent, first inning, same batter, fastball, okay? That's the whole point of this, just to show you the difference of mechanics that, as subtle as they are, can really translate to something completely different and a different view for the hitter. So we got three views to show you. Your traditional center field, down the line, high center field camera that you would see for every pitch in a game. We've got the low third base side, you know, the profile view, the head-on view of Jacob Mizorowski. And then finally, from behind home, the mid-home view, that robo camera that sits on the netting. So same ballpark, same cameras. You know, angles don't get wonky with this. That's why I chose these two games. So let's try to put on our thinking caps here and show you some of the things that I notice when I compare the mechanics year over year of Jacob Mizorowski. Let's start with down the line here from center field. I'm just going to play it out once through here for you. Obviously, the old version is on the right. The new version of Miz is here on the left. You can tell by the City Connect jersey. So we're looping it through a few times. They look extremely similar, of course, but I want to break down a few things that I noticed here. First and foremost, as we go back to the start, let me pause it and go frame by frame. Going back to the very beginning of this too, notice how his stance is just a little bit more closed off to the batter here when we look at his hips versus a year ago. You can see a little bit more of the belt buckle, right? You can see just sort of a little bit of a preset here. This will really come out in the low third view of Jacob Mizorowski. Now, as we play this out, and I'll go ahead and play it in a quarter speed now because those were already in half speed. As we bring it to the top, things look really similar. I would say, if anything, one thing that I noticed from Miz is just how upright he is compared to a little bit more posture rounded. I don't know if that was necessarily envisioned when Miz made these changes, but it'll make more sense here as we move forward in this video. So a little bit more compact, a little bit more condensed top of the leg kick here for Miz. But now as we really slow it down, and I'm going to go frame by frame now as these are synced up, of how much lower Miz is getting. Now, it may not seem like a lot as you watch here, frame by frame, but as I draw a line to show you, you know, this year versus last year, I think that's a pretty big difference when you can see the angles like that of how much lower he is getting frame by frame, and then that allows him to explode forward. In looking at the numbers, the vertical release height is not really that different. We're within inches of this from a season ago. Now, that's not significant enough to talk about when we're talking about release height. Now, if we're talking he's going from 4.8 feet to, you know, 5.1 feet, now that's a different story, but that's not what's happening here. But by getting down lower and using that new trunk that he has, I mean, let's all say what we're thinking here as we're watching here on YouTube. The dude got stronger. The dude got a lower half finally. He got built, like we've talked about, how he's gained pant sizes. You can see it here, using it to his advantage to try to get lower in his squat, in his delivery, down to the plate. Now, again, going frame by frame, as we open up the hips, as we open up and we get ready to land on that foot. Now, all five toes are down on this same frame. Okay, this is the first moment all five toes are down on that front foot. What's the first thing you notice? Again, I am looking at that rotation of the upper body. Okay, see how much of the letters that you can see on Miz in the old version versus the new version? This is under control. This is where that strength is coming in. He's not relying on flailing open. He's not relying on really trying to rotate hard. Now, you need to rotate hard, obviously, to throw effective pitches, but you can see where the strength is really coming through here, that having an on-time delivery where you're not leaning, and this will really come through in the mid-home view, where you can see the angle of his body is really sort of got a curve. This is back to that straight version that we're talking about. Now, moving a little bit further into this plant and into this fire, watch the follow-through here, and I'll just put this in regular speed.
Watch his tippy toes on the old version. Okay? Now you've seen the tiptoes on that front leg, whereas on the new version, he is staying down. He is staying heel engaged with the mound as he releases the pitch. That's that core balance that Chris Hook has talked about. That's what Miz has said. The water bag has really helped him maintain his delivery, maintain staying over that plant leg and firing through. All five toes down and the heel engaged with the mound keeps you engaged moving forward. His strength is really showing here in the down-the-line difference from last year to this year. Next, let's go to the low third base face-on view here for Jacob Mizorowski. Now, I had to cut off the head a little bit, but again, sync these up from the same moment the pitch is thrown and everything like that. So once again, just like we did with the last one, let's just watch a few on our own. Old version is on the bottom, new version is on the top. Now, the angle was slightly different year over year here, so I did my best to keep it level, so that's why it may look like the bottom extension is longer. The extension numbers are virtually the same here for each of these pitches. So now that we've looked at it a few times, let me break down a couple of things that I noticed and maybe some things that we already talked about so far in this video. First of all, we talk about that preset hip. One of the ways you can easily see it here, look how turned in his front leg is. He's trying to set that hip and kind of load in early to create that squat and create that rotation in the beginning of his rotation. Now, again, as I play it frame by frame, it's a little bit more over the back leg, whereas this is a little bit more straight up, and then he turns. So that's one of the things that you're easily able to notice when you watch this frame by frame. And again, you see that line that we're talking about. We're across the body here. Oh, here, let me change the colors on that. We're across here. We're across the belt buckle here, whereas we're a little bit more upright. Now, that's an exaggerated view, but I think you can see that on your own of just we're a little bit over the back leg now versus this one's just slightly behind it. It's not a bad thing here. But now, as we explode into the pitch, when I go and look here at that back foot, look at the new back foot, how much lower that shin is to the ground versus down here on the old back foot. See how much lower and long the stride is. Now, he's still getting elite extension, but we look at the body one more time at the stability that he has created versus the lean that we see in the old version. He's a much more upright in the new version as he strides, as he has very little space on the bottom of the shin, indicating he is staying low and engaged, using the mound to his advantage. Now, when we go into the final set here, boom, we release the baseball. Look at that. The foot is still engaged with the mound. Down here, the foot is off the mound. The balance, the strength that we talk about to stay engaged using his core versus this one is just using pure arm strength, which, hey, he got by on it, but by the end of this game, last Labor Day, he was sitting 98-99. Now, adrenaline had something to do with this game, but again, he broke his own record for pitches over 100 miles an hour. He set the new record for pitches over 101 miles an hour. I mean, the list goes on of how impressive the body changes have been for Jacob Mizorowski to follow through. And again, this is the same pitch that we saw earlier where, look at the tiptoe. That left leg is stuck in the ground on the new version. And the bottom version, he is tiptoeing. He is kind of pirouetting over that front leg. The strength and the stability that he has created allows him to put more finish on pitches and thus a couple more ticks of elo. Now, the last view I wanted to point out here is the mid-home, kind of the slash camera, if you will, of that robo camera from right on the net. When we watch this a few times through, and I know it might look a little funky given the guy on the left is not on a mound using the rotoscope tool here in Adobe, but I just want to show one more time that posture that we see a little bit of a difference of, especially on the follow through and on the way down. Looks very similar right now, but then as we go step by step, frame by frame, the moment he plants, again, we're starting to see the difference come through for Miz. Right at release, okay, we see a strong core here, up and down. We're starting to see a lean over here. And as we play that out, we see that. That's fine. We're still staying over the baseball. But when we go backwards a little bit, we can really see it on his way down as he lunges. Look at this rotation on the left side. As he lands on the left, he rotates and pulls. And you can see that back in that arch that he has created here, where he's just a little rounded on his way down. Whereas as we look over on the other side, he lands, rotates, but we can see a flat sort of straight downward and staying in plane and staying with his shoulders level, not trying to create too big of an angle. Now, naturally, you are going to have an angle when you are throwing a baseball. But as he releases the baseball, again, we don't see that tiptoe. We don't see the wild getting off the plane of the release. Yes, he's going to follow through and kick. When you throw 100 miles an hour, all that energy has to go somewhere. But when I'm watching Miz one more time in the control that he has as he lands, as he fires, wouldn't you want to be a hitter when you're watching this right now? What, I mean, look at the where he starts, right? He's on the extreme first base side of the rubber, and he's landing essentially down the middle of the mound. That is creating a little bit more deception that you may not anticipate. And you talk about, you talk to hitters and they try to pick up something, try to understand where should I be looking for his release point? Where should I be trying to find the baseball? I remember Rudy Jaramillo, who's a legendary hitting coach, used to always say, you got to start on the logo of the cap and then go over to find the baseball. Well, if you're starting on the logo of the cap for Miz, look how much space he's created here from the logo of the cap to the ball. That's time for your eyes to travel. That's time for you to pick up the baseball. And then more time for your eyes to calibrate and realize, all right, what kind of spin am I seeing? Fastball. Oh, no, it's by me. That's what makes Mizorowski such an impressive arm, even without the velocity. I believe this is a deceptive enough delivery that if it's 96, 97 miles an hour with the vert numbers and with the, you know, low release height that he possesses, it is still very hard to pick up. And it's just a bonus that he also throws 103 miles an hour. So those are a few of the mechanical things that I saw and learned from Hookie, learned from Miz about some of the things that he's been doing lately and trying to make sure that it becomes repeatable. I've said this a few times to some folks, and I think I've said it on a few postgame shows too, that what a wild sentence to say. That when we watch Jacob Mizorowski pitch, it's a repeatable delivery. Isn't that wild? And last year, we'd see him get all over the place. The limbs are going kind of crazy. When he gets out of sync, that tends to happen from time to time. But that we see the fruits of his labor. We see the strength in the lower body and the core, the continued work on the water bag with everybody in the pitching staff to say, hey, you need to be balanced. You need to work these small muscles to maintain the engine of the big muscles. You've heard Chris Hook say that before. The lower body is the engine of any pitcher. We all have assumptions about arms and arm health and that sort of thing. It all has to start from your lower body. And to see Miz put on the pounds that he put on for his lower body in the offseason, to now seeing it pay off that he's still, you know, on this historic 8-game, 9-game stretch right now, that the velo hasn't ticked down as the innings have gone up. The Brewers are going to be very conscious of how he is used moving forward. They need to make sure they have him in October, of course. I'm not saying he's going to skip starts, but you're going to see more situations like the situation we saw this week where Miz actually, you know, skipped a couple of days, gets an extra day of rest in order to align things. The Brewers have 18 games in 17 days coming up. They'll have a good stretch coming up out of the All-Star break too. And also, Miz is probably going to pitch in the All-Star game. So that's another date that you have to keep on your calendar to make sure that he's ready to go with. These are some of the things that I look at. Again, reclaiming the disclaimer. I talk to guys about this. I talk to Miz. I talk to Hookie about this. And again, I'm not a pitching coach. But these are just the things that trying to express that the work that he has put in is paying off on top of just being a good kid, man. I like it when good humans do good things. And Miz is certainly in that category. So I hope you enjoyed that breakdown. The numbers are gaudy. I don't have the force plate numbers. I don't have the jump test. I don't have any of that stuff. But I think you and I can both understand just looking at his lower half in these clips. Yeah, he has definitely gotten stronger to be a big league pitcher. All right, let's take a breather. Come back with more. Brewers Weekly rolls on 620 WTMJ and on ESPN Milwaukee.
This is Brewers Weekly on WTMJ.
Welcome back, Brewers Weekly. Pleased to be joined by Garrett Mitchell as the Brewers get ready to hit the road to Atlanta and then Cincinnati and
Garrett, it's been a really good month or so for you offensively. Really, the whole season is really coming to what you know you're capable of. When you arrived opening day, finally healthy again, into what we are now here in the middle of June, how could have pictured any better? How do you think these first 2.5 months or so have gone?
Yeah, I mean, I think they've gone good so far. I mean, I look at it as, of course, you could do better. Or there's more things that we could fine-tune, but that's kind of what a season looks like, right? It's constantly fine-tuning, turning the dial, pulling back a little bit, like figuring out kind of what that right speed is. So I think we're in a great spot right now.
When you look at your last couple of seasons, we've talked about it before, just getting on the field, right? And you've always said that in spring training, even through maybe some of the struggles you had in April, it's just getting into the games. As simple as that sounds, what are the things maybe a level deeper that you're looking for out of those games?
Yeah, I mean, I think it, with everything, it's really all about process. It's all in the work, right? And when you're getting to do it every day, it's getting to feel things. I think for us a lot as baseball players, it's like you can look at it, but for us as players, it's a feeling. Like when you're in the box, like how you're trying to feel. It's not like, oh, you look at a video and go, how am I turning? Or like, how are my hands? It's like, no, it's like you can't explain it more than just like you feel it. It's like an intuition. It's IQ. But I think with everything, like the more times you're able to repeat it, the more times you're able to do it in low-level situations, which is in the cage just working on stuff. And then the game where it's high intensity, high emotion, like when you get to do that over a full year, you learn a lot more about yourself. And it's very challenging doing that when you're only playing a handful of games, you know?
When you look at the things that you've worked on this season in particular, you know, we've talked to you about contact, we've talked to you about high fastballs, but now you can see the levers turning, right? You can see things moving in the right direction. What does that work look like for you, whether it be in the cage, in game, and the feedback you get to improve on your craft?
Yeah, I mean, from a work standpoint, the work's pretty much been the same, but it's like working from top to bottom, being able to cover the top, and my honey hole and my hot spots are down, so it's more just being prepared for both. When I say down, it's not looking down, it's just reacting to that down, because when you're looking down, you start swinging at stuff below the zone, which is not good. So I think having your eyes at the top and being aware of where the top is, and then just being a baseball player and being reactionary to everything else is good. So that's kind of been the process for me.
When you look at, you know, the ball you hit the other night here against Cleveland, where kind of what you're talking about, it's a breaking ball, it's down, and you turn and burn on it. Is that kind of the picture of how it's supposed to look, right? Kind of like what you're just describing of you're ready for the heater, you identify the breaking ball, and you hit the ball hard and good things happen?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you even see in that at bat too, I get a slider up and a slider down, so I kind of got all three of them. And I think that also helps too, right? You're not actively thinking about it as you're doing it, but you get to see spin a couple times, so like when you get it and it's in the zone that you're looking for, put a good swing on it.
When you look at this season for this club, right? I know you didn't get to be around it a lot last season with the Brewers, but what is the clubhouse vibe right now, and compared to last year, from what this team was able to do with 97 wins, and now you're on one heck of a pace again this season?
I think the clubhouse is the same. You know, I think like what changes year to year is the confidence level and the expectations. The expectation level hasn't changed either, and you know how that works. But just as the young guys are becoming a little bit older, the vets who have continued to be the vets, and the new guys that are coming in, I think we just know that it comes down to doing our job, and it's not trying to do any more or any less. You're not going out there trying to do more, trying to do something that isn't yourself, and like that's what I think us as a team, we do a really good job as. We kind of just put together quality at bat after quality at bat, and when you see like an inning last night where we go up, you know, four runs in an inning and we come back and put a two spot on, like those are things that really pile into quality games, winning in the margins. Another thing, like we've had some games where like maybe we didn't play as well as we should have, or like the offense was dead for a lot, like most of the game, and then we figure out a way to win some of those ugly games, which that's where I feel like that's been a step up this year. I don't know what those numbers look like on paper. Like if you were to break them down, you would know them better than I do. But it's felt like we've have figured out ways to win regardless of if we're hot at the plate or we haven't found it for seven innings, but just doing what it takes to win. And again, no different than years past, but it just feels like the confidence level individually from each guy, but as a group, is like, you got to get 27 outs. Like, until you get 27 outs, like, we got a shot. And I think that's been shown a lot this year already.
Last one for you, Garrett. I mean, just as the human, right? Last year, you're injured, you're missing the season. We got to see you in the NLCS and see the guys again. But just mentally, how are you doing just to be able to be playing ball at the level that you're playing and just being around this team while they're having success?
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, this is where you want to be, right? Like, being in Arizona or being anywhere but here is, like, the worst. So being able to help the team and contribute, but also just be here every day, can't ask for anything more.
All right, Garrett Mitchell joining us on Brewers Weekly. Good luck on the road and enjoy some sunshine, and thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, of course. Thank you.
All right, our last few seconds of the program, my thanks to Garrett once again, and thank you for listening. Brewers All Access, wherever you get your podcast. Hey, by the way, while you're here, you listen to a whole show, if you listen to me break down Miz, drop a rating, drop a 5-star, drop a review if you so wish, or 1-star if you don't like it. I don't mind. We would appreciate it. It's really helpful this time of year to just kind of see where we're going near the halfway point, because you guys, the listeners, have let me know, and I appreciate every single one of you that have been listening for as long as you have. So we have post-game shows all weekend long against the Braves, and get your popcorn ready because the Miz gets the ball on Friday night against the third-best team in the National League, a team that is leading its division in ATL. That's going to do it for this show. My thank you so much to you for listening. I'm Dominic Catronio. Until next time, keep on smiling.